books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today I chat to Ben Markowitz about his book, The Rest of Our Lives. Plus, we'll find some new musical books in the RNIB library and some biographies narrated by their authors.
All that and more on today's Read On.
The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz is described as an unforgettable road trip of a novel about a middle-aged academic whose marriage, career, and body are failing him. The audio version of the book is read by Eric Myers.
When our son was 12 years old, my wife had an affair with a guy called Zach Zersky, whom she knew from synagogue. He was a little younger, 3 or 4 years, had 3 boys, all younger than our 2 kids, but was in some sense in the same position as my wife. They both had partners who made good money, which meant they didn't have to do much and got bored and restless and maybe even depressed. Zach's wife was head of oncology at Westchester County. I saw Zach touch Amy's hand under the fold-out table at the Purim food bank drive, under the paper cloth. He was short, about 5'8", broad-shouldered, and dark. He wore linen shirts open at the chest. His chest hair had started going gray. On Sundays, he played guitar for the kids at Temple Beth and taught them Jewish songs like Spin, Spin, Sevivon, very pro-Israel, in a tree-planting, happy-clappy way. He was the kind of guy who danced with all the old ladies and little pigtailed girls at a bar mitzvah, so he could also put his arm around the pretty mothers and nobody would complain. Even before I saw them holding hands, I didn't like him.
It's a book about what happens to a marriage once the kids leave home and the couple have to find a new shape to their lives.
The main protagonist, he'd sort of made a deal with himself about 12 years ago.
Yes, yeah, that's right. So it starts off with the narrator, whose name is Tom. His wife had an affair when the kids were small, and he makes a deal with himself that when the youngest leaves home, he can walk out on the marriage. And the novel opens when he drops his daughter at university, and instead of driving home again, he keeps going across America.
My parents are Catholic, but my dad thought religion was just a big fancy dress party, and he hated fancy dress. Maybe this is why I never got involved in the synagogue, which meant Amy had a whole social network where she had an identity, and I didn't. She told me about Zach after I already knew, and after it was already over. Amy had highly developed guilt feelings, which were so strong she couldn't help being mad at whoever she felt guilty toward, which was often me. She said she wanted to make me mad, too. She just wanted some kind of reaction. That's all she was looking for. But that's not really my style. If there's something you can do to fix something, I try to do it. But in this case, I wasn't sure what. She said, "You don't feel anything about anything." I said, "Everything I do for you and the kids. Nothing else matters to me." "So what do you want to do?" I asked her. "Do you want a divorce?" But she didn't want that. At least, not until the kids had left home. The home and the kids were all she had to show for the last 12 years of her life. The thing with Zach didn't mean anything. It was more like a kind of self-harm. She knew that I knew that when she was a teenager, she used to cut herself on the thigh. A bid for attention. But Amy's a person who tells stories about her motives and actions, which are very persuasive to her as well. So it's sometimes hard to talk about or even work out what's really going on.
And it's not really a deliberate, he doesn't bash his fist on the table and say, I'm going on a road trip. He just sort of meanders away.
Yeah, that's right. And I almost hesitate to say that he made this deal with himself because it was a long time ago. It's not like he'd been planning it the whole way through. In fact, his wife was supposed to come along on the drive where they dropped off his daughter. It's just something that kind of builds, a kind of pressure in his life has been growing and growing. And so instead of turning home again after he says goodbye to his daughter, who he was very close to, he decides to set off in another direction. And he ends up seeing various people from his old life, his brother, an ex-girlfriend, a college buddy, and eventually his son in California. That's why he keeps driving to California.
What was the initial seed? Did you want to write a road trip novel, or did you want to look at a couple's marriage?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't always remember. I'm not a completely reliable witness. I just sat down and wrote the opening page. I don't know why it occurred to me or what I was doing when it occurred to me, but I came back to it a few months later and I thought there were some interesting things there. Thought it was interesting that it wasn't the man who'd had the affair, that he felt he'd done nothing wrong. And that was going to be part of the story, that he has to realize that maybe feeling like you've done nothing wrong is part of the problem. And the road trip sort of grew out of the conceit, which is that he drops his daughter off at university. I think on some level, we all love a road trip. Like a lot of us love a road trip. And it was a way of making a story about the breakdown of a marriage have an element of adventure to it so that it wasn't all heavy.
Now, you mentioned you're not a reliable witness. So how reliable a narrator is Tom?
What did you think?
I think he's, to put it in a Scottish way, he's kidding himself on. Plus,
yeah,
he's being like all men and ignoring symptoms that he really should get looked at as well. He should have more action. You know, he's been very passive, especially with his own health.
I guess so. I mean, it's funny you say he's been passive because he does start off by driving across America and leaving his marriage behind, which seems like a fairly active thing to do. Yeah, I actually was never a fan of the phrase unreliable narrator, because most narrators are reliable in one way or another. You just might not agree with them. And I guess I would say about Tom that it's not that he's unreliable in any shifty or deceptive sense. It's just that he has a view of what's going on that the reader might not necessarily share. It doesn't mean he's wrong, but it seems to me one of the things I could explore in the novel was the limit of his worldview.
Yeah, his worldview does seem to be, well, he sees the world in grades. He grades everything.
Yes.
He tells himself he's got a C minus marriage.
Yeah, I thought that was the last line of the opening section that I'd written. And I like moments in a character's life where what they think seems both on the one hand kind of reasonable, but on the other totally crazy. So what he says is that if you have a wife who'd had an affair, if you have a C minus marriage is what he says, it's hard to score much higher than a B on the rest of your life. And I could see why he would say that, but it seems like obviously the wrong way of looking at your life and your marriage. He has reasons for viewing his life through the lens of grades. He was an academic striver. He's a professor. He's worked very hard to get into his position so that it comes naturally to him to think of life in terms of measurable achievement. But it's also getting him down, and he has to learn of a new way of thinking about his life.
Yeah, because in the novel, he's suspended or he's on leave, and he doesn't think that's his fault either.
He doesn't really think it's his fault. You thought it was his fault?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't go into a lot of detail about why he gets suspended, but he feels isolated at work.
It's a hard question. It's just a hard question to answer because I'm thinking of the David Mamet play, Oleana.
Yeah.
Where, you know, they're both right and they're both wrong.
That's what you hope for, right? Whenever I tell a story about any kind of disagreement, I hope that they're both right and they're both wrong.
You fall in love with somebody when you're 26, and you see them in all kinds of different lights and according to their potential. But after years and years of marriage and shared parenting and all the other shared decisions you have to make just to get through the days, you accumulate a lot of data about that person that after a while just seems more or less accurate. If you continue to have illusions, that's your fault. So, If you stay married, it's because you've accepted that this is what they're like and what your life with them is like, and you stop expecting them to do or give you things you know perfectly well they're unlikely to do or give you. It's like being a Knicks fan. But I also made a deal with myself. When Miriam goes to college, you can leave too. Maybe this was just another one of those illusions, but it helped me get through the first few months after Amy told me about Zach. And for the sake of the kids, we had to pretend that everything was fine. When in fact what we obviously had, even when things smoothed over, was a C-minus marriage, which makes it pretty hard to score much higher than a B overall on the rest of your life. 12 years later, Miriam turned 18. We spent the first few weeks of August on Cape Cod. Amy's family had a house in Wellfleet, which you had to book a year in advance, and even then there was a lot of overlapping and arguing about beds. It had a studio in the yard where you could potentially sleep as many people as you had mattresses for, and for that reason, in one corner there was a pile of old mattresses under the eaves. If you didn't mind sharing a bathroom or walking out in the morning to take a leak off the deck. Normally, I stayed in the city and came up only on the weekends, but it was Miriam's last summer at home, so I took 2 weeks off.
More from Ben Markowitz after we get some musical recommendations from RNIB Live.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Prince, Purple Rain by Mick Wall was given to us by Trapeze from the Hachette Group.
Dispatcher, 911... Where is your emergency? Unidentified male. Hi there. What's the address here? Yeah, we need an ambulance right now. Okay. We have someone who is unconscious. Okay. What's the address? We're at Prince's house. Okay. Does anybody know the address? Is there any mail around that you could look at? Yeah. Okay. Hold on. Okay, your cell phone's not going to tell me where you're at, so I need you to find me an address.
The person is dead here.
Okay, get me the address, please.
Okay, I'm working on it.
Concentrate on that.
And the people are just distraught.
I understand that they are distraught, but I'm working on it. Okay, do we know how the person died?
I don't know.
Okay.
We're in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we are at the home of Prince.
You're in Minneapolis?
Yeah, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
You're sure you are in Minneapolis?
That's correct.
Okay. Have you found an address yet?
Yeah. I'm so sorry. I need the address here.
Unidentified female.
7801.
7801. 7801 what?
Paisley Park. We're at Paisley Park.
You're at Paisley Park, okay. That's in Chanhassen. Are you with the person who...
Yes, it's Prince.
Okay.
The person.
Okay. Stay on the line with me.
Okay.
There's a phone ringing. Ambulance dispatcher.
Ambulance, Shirley.
Carver with the transfer for Paisley Park Studios, 78.
Paisley Park Studios, okay.
7801 Audubon Road.
Okay.
We have a person down, not breathing.
Down, not breathing.
Yup.
This is the powerful, detailed, and enlightening biography of the iconic composer, singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist, the inimitable Prince. Prince was an icon, a man who defined an era of music and changed the shape of popular culture forever. There's no doubt that he was one of the most talented and influential artists of all time, and also one of the most mysterious. On the 21st of April 2016, the world lost its Prince. It was the day the music died. This book will open a door to Prince's world like never before, from his traumatic childhood and pursuit of music as a means to escape, to his rise to superstardom, professional rivalries, and marriages shrouded in tragedy. Music writer Mick Wall explores the historical, cultural and personal backdrop that gave rise to an artist the likes of which the world has never seen and never will again.
Purple is the most special of all the major colours, the one that appears the least frequently in nature. A synthesis of red and blue, male and female, fire and water, yin and yang. Purple is always the colour that attracts the most attention. In China, purple represents the harmony of the universe, spiritual awareness, a red purple symbolizing fame and great fortune. In Japan, purple symbolizes privilege and wealth, aristocracy. In Europe and America, for centuries, the color purple has been associated with vanity, extravagance, and individualism, with magic and mystery. In parapsychology, people with purple auras are said to have a love of ritual and ceremony. Now, since 1984, purple has become the color symbolizing the greatest musician of his generation, Prince, an artist for whom all of the above meanings would apply. 100 million records sold, 7 Grammy Awards, an Oscar, a multitude of Brits, MTV and American Music Awards. A musical innovator on a par with David Bowie, a guitarist to rival Jimi Hendrix, a better dancer than James Brown, and a singer with more than one voice and many more ways than one of expressing it. Prince achieved more in his 4-decade career than other artists achieve in a lifetime. And then there were the women.
Prince, Purple Rain, by Mick Wall, is read by Colin Mace and runs for 6 hours and 12 minutes.
Live Aid, The Definitive Inside Story by Paul Vallely, was donated by Simon & Schuster.
It's been a year of anniversaries. Not just Live Aid. It's also 20 years since we organised the Live 8 concerts in the home countries of the 8 world leaders who could do something about the unbearable yoke of debt which hung around the necks of the people of Africa. That began with a challenge from Vallely. He wrote somewhere, "For all his skill as a populist, Bob Geldof could not shift the agenda from one of charity to one of justice." That stung. But it set me on an extraordinary adventure just as improbable, just as thrilling, just as profound, and, without any shadow of doubt, just as impactful and bonkers as all the records, concerts, bands, performances, trucks, ships, food aid, and all the other stuff. It took me from pop and poverty through the practicalities of politics to learn how to pull on the levers of power.
In 1985, Bob Geldof took a trip across Africa to decide how the Live Aid money should be spent. He asked Paul Vallely to accompany him. Over the next 4 decades, Vallely became one of Geldof's closest advisors, travelling with him to meet the world's top rock stars and politicians. Here, for the first time, Vallely gives his full eyewitness account of what happened backstage at Live Aid and Live 8, the biggest collective event in human history.
But whatever my desire and need to return to the music, which came naturally to me, I was also obliged to continue with Band Aid and what flowed from it. It had become simply too big. The responsibility was, at least it seemed to me, to take this thing we had conjured out of the flimsiest soil to its ultimate, logical, political, economic conclusion. But obviously not by myself. I understood this at the absolute very beginning of all of it, when I made that phone call to Midge Ure, my fellow writer, singer, musician. I made many calls like that, always the same. Will you help? The answer was always the same. Yes. Band Aid had worked. For once in our bloody lives, something had actually worked exactly as we had imagined, but on a vastly different scale to anything any of us had anticipated. The people who, for whatever personal and or professional reason, had gathered about me to enable the realisation of this absurdly normal and originally pedestrian idea of using your ability, in my case writing tunes, to stop others starving, were, as you will read, extraordinarily gifted individuals, each to their own professions, but equally as personalities and as thinking, adventurous, daring, compassionate human beings. They were a bunch of rebels or outlaws by inclination and by any standard, but so very good at their jobs. Whatever their chosen profession, they had made it to the top. Others gave up everything, tossing up their lives to gather round this struggling Irishman to make his mad, blustering convictions a brilliant reality. No one got paid, ever. They just did it. 'Cause they could, and they wanted to, and it was working. So why stop?
Live Aid, the definitive 40-year story, by Paul Vallely, is read by David Thorpe and runs for 26 hours and 16 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now a return to my chat with Ben Markowitz on his book, The Rest of Our Lives. The audio version is read by Eric Myers.
Amy's big brother Richard had the main house with his new wife. They had a new baby. His other two kids were in their 30s. One of them had a baby of her own. That's why they got the house and we got the studio. Seemed reasonable to me, although Amy thought it was just another example of how her family prioritized Richard. Her dad, whom she idolized, had died years ago when Amy was still in high school. Her relationship with her mother was more complicated. Anyway, one of the funny little things that happened is that Esther, Amy's mother, let Richard and Kelsey stay in the master bedroom, which had the only ensuite, even though in the past, when we shared the house with Esther, she insisted on sleeping in her own room. That's because Tom only came for the weekend, she explained. I'm Tom. So on some level, of course, it was my fault. But there are too many Naftalis to keep track of them all, and most of them don't matter to this story.
Now, what's the difference between basketball and pickup basketball?
So pickup basketball is basketball. It's just a kind of subculture of it. There are pickup basketball. There are places you can play pickup basketball in England, too. It basically just means you show up at a public court, and there's a kind of protocol or etiquette for how you get in the game. And pickup just means that there are no organized teams, there are no referees. You just show up and find some strangers to play with, and you start playing.
So it's a more social game.
It's a social game. It's actually a really wonderful thing to do. I don't play pickup much anymore, but when I was younger, I used to show up at a lot of public courts, see if I could get in a game and start hanging out with people I'd never met before. And it's a way for people from widely different backgrounds to hang out together doing something they love.
Now, we'll talk about the cover. It's a rear-view mirror. So what do you think? Is he driving away or towards?
That's right. So it's a rear-view mirror, and you've got the sun going down in the background. I would say, so sun rises in the east and sets in the west. It's interesting because he's heading west in the book, but the image suggests, unless it's the dawn, maybe it's the dawn, the sun is coming up and he's setting off, and there's another person in the car. So based on the story, it suggests that it's Tom driving off with his daughter on the way to university before he cuts out across the country. I really like the cover. One of the things I like about it is that it seems both trashy and classy at the same time. You can imagine taking it to the beach. It's got a very vivid lilac at the top and a quite bright orange at the bottom. And the title itself is in a mix of off-white and yellow. So all the colors kind of pop off the page. There's a cartoonish element too, but there's a kind of poignancy as well, I think, this sense of a life lived under a declining sun.
I met Amy in grad school in Boston. She was doing her master's in education while I was in my third year of a PhD on the 60s American novel, just at the point where you have to start writing. So I fantasized about dropping out and going to law school. Amy was actually dating a friend of mine, Ethan Conchar, until he won a fellowship to the Max Planck Institute in Göttingen. The farewell party was at his apartment in Somerville, which he shared with another grad school buddy, Sam Tierney. Amy was an unusually beautiful woman, but also nice about it. Her strategy was just to, like, keep still, so she didn't give off false flares. But naturally, it meant she also drew a lot of attention. People at the party kept commiserating with her because Ethan was going away, and she's the kind of person who wants to please people by acting and feeling what they expect her to feel. That night, she got stuck in the kitchen where the drinks were, and people came up to her and said things like, "When are you going to see him again?" At that point, it still wasn't clear if they were staying together. She's about 5'10", with terrific posture. For most of her childhood, she wanted to be a ballerina, but then got too big. Amy doesn't actually look particularly Jewish. She has long brown curly hair, which she wears past her shoulders, and a strong, handsome, waspy face. She even modeled for a wristwatch company in college. She looks like the kind of woman who can ride a horse, which she actually can. For her last 2 years of high school, she went to Brearley. After her dad died, they moved back to New York.
There is a lot in the book about the state of America today. Do you think living in London, you've got quite a unique view of America, looking at it from such distance?
Yeah, I think in some ways it helps, in other ways it hurts. I think if you actually live in a place, you sometimes get so caught up in what's going on that you can't get your head above the water. Whereas I've spent most of my adulthood in Europe, and I go back to America all the time, but I see it almost as a stranger might. So I think there are elements that make that, there's something about that that makes it easier for me to write about it occasionally. On the other hand, of course, I'm also more distant from it, and that can make it harder too.
This book, it's very conversational in tone. Were you reading it out loud to yourself as you were writing it?
Sometimes I do. Most of the time I try to write the kind of sentences that I would actually say. I feel like the reason we talk the way that we do is because it's the most effective way of getting our thoughts across. And sometimes there's this temptation when you're staring at the screen to use the kind of fancy language you would never use in real life. And I try to avoid it as much as possible. I'd like to be able to say every sentence in the book in my natural voice or in Tom's natural voice.
Now, Tom's not well. He gets sicker during the road trip. Now, I believe you did a similar road trip, not alone, but with your family, but you were having almost exactly the same symptoms.
I was, yes. I gave Tom these symptoms before I knew what I had. And by the end of the book, by the time I finished the first draft, I was going through chemo. Just to touch on something you mentioned earlier, I mean, I suppose it's true that Tom doesn't spend a lot of time dealing with his medical symptoms, but that's partly just because it happens off stage. He does say that he went to the doctor and they couldn't find anything wrong. He has tried to come to terms with what's happening to him medically. And the truth was the same for me. I did keep going back to the doctor saying, "There's something wrong with me. I know it." And the doctor took a look at me and said, "I can't find out what it is." So it can be harder to diagnose this kind of lymphoma than you might think. So I don't think it's just purely an example of Tom's passivity that he didn't get it dealt with. It just is really hard sometimes to find out what's going on inside yourself.
Yeah, for a while you thought it was long COVID.
I thought it was long COVID, yeah. The doctor ran me through all these tests. I mean, by the end, I had all kinds of symptoms that eventually when I saw an oncologist shouted to her that I had some kind of obstruction that she sent me away to get scanned for. So when the diagnosis came, it happened very quickly, but for a long time, I couldn't figure out what was wrong.
I got her number from Ethan and called a few weeks after the party to see how she was doing. He said they'd split up. But even when we started dating, she felt like she was cheating on him, which made the first few months much more intense with anybody else I ever went out with. It was a big deal for her when she invited me to the Cape before Christmas. In those days, I still felt like the older guy. I was 26, she was 23, I had a car, a Toyota Corolla I bought by working as a customer service agent for Alaska Airlines. I used to spend weekends out at Logan, from curb to cabin. That was my responsibility. We drove out on Route 6 while the continent narrowed around us, and even though it was about 20 degrees outside, but bright, icy winter sunshine, she made me stop at the Wellfleet Dairy Bar and mini golf. Though, of course, it was closed out of season, she just wanted to show me. Every summer, before they went up to the house, her dad pulled over to buy them ice creams. This was my first real contact with the little childish rituals rich people have towards some of the blessings in their lives.
You were writing the sentences that you would say out loud, and we've heard through the magic of editing, Eric Myers reading from the book. Were you responsible in any way for the casting of Eric?
So, yeah, I was given two options, and Eric was one of them. They were both very good actors. They both read very well. What I liked about Eric is that he seemed to me to combine the different qualities that I wanted Tom to have. And what I mean by that is that Tom is clearly educated and he should have an educated American voice. He's a professor, but that's not the whole of his background. His childhood was, you know, a little tougher than that might suggest. His dad had run off when he was a teenager. He was raised by a single mom. He kind of identifies himself, not as working class, because that would be inaccurate, but he's a little suspicious of some of the more upper middle class people that he spends his life among. And I wanted that to be captured in the voice.
Now, you're an American academic. Did you not think about reading the book yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't asked to. I have read a couple of my novels. I read two of them, and it's really hard work. I did like doing it, but I'm not a trained actor. So, yeah, if they had asked me to do it, I would have done it. But they had these excellent actors that I could choose from, and so I chose one of them.
How did you find the books that you did narrate?
Well, the trouble I had was they put you in this very tiny sound-sensitive booth. And around 11 o'clock, it's a long working day. I'd sort of read from 9 till 5. My tummy would start rumbling. And because the mic was so sensitive, it would pick up every sound coming from my stomach. And I found that if I ate, it rumbled because I was digesting. And if I didn't eat, it rumbled because I was hungry. So it was a big physical effort was involved in just trying to stay silent enough to get the reading out. But I really did like doing it. As I said, I try to write the kind of sentences I could say. So it was an interesting test of my literary style.
Yeah, for an hour before lunch, your stomach complains. And then for an hour after lunch, your stomach's saying thank you.
Yes, exactly. And all of it gets picked up on the mic and you have to reread the sentence.
Yeah. But now that it is available in audio and it's also available in Braille from RNIB, it's available to someone for whatever reason doesn't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Yeah, it is. And actually, I mean, audio is much bigger business than it was when I started out. But I think a lot of people want to take in stories through their ears, sometimes because it's the only way they can absorb them. But at other times, just because it suits their life better.
So is there anyone in your life who sort of needs audiobooks?
Well, there are, but also when I was a kid, my grandmother lived with us for a while, and she had had an eye operation that went wrong and could see only very dimly. And we used to get books on tape, which were often read by, I think, just volunteers. And I would sit and listen to them with her, including Finnegan's Wake, which was an amazing thing to listen to on tape. And I used to read to her as well. You know, it was one of the ways that we would interact. She had also had a number of strokes so that she couldn't formulate her sentences sometimes in the way that she wanted to, but it meant that we had this shared topic of conversation that we could keep coming back to. It was a very important part of our relationship.
Do you still listen to books on audio?
I do, yeah, especially on car rides. You also asked me about whether I had ever read out my own books, and my mother now can't really see well enough to read anymore, but she loves books on tape. And to have my work available through audio is very important to me.
Amy was a late sleeper until we had kids. I got up early to work, but really just wandered around. The house had no central heating. They used rusty old gas canister heaters, which had wheels and that you had to light with a match. I didn't trust myself, so made coffee and warmed my hands on that. Some of the sofas and chairs had wool blankets draped over them. The big wall of glass in the living room faced west, so in the morning it was all in shade. We stayed a week. before her brother came with his first wife. But there was no overlap. It snowed heavily halfway through, and the roads only just cleared in time for us to drive back to Boston, where I dropped her off at her apartment, and then drove on to Trenton, where my mother lived, on her own. So I always spent Christmas with her. Over the break, I started studying for my LSATs and formally dropped out of grad school a few months later. By that point, I was already in love with Amy and figured that for the kind of life we might want to have together, I needed to make more money. But I didn't want to write the book anyway.
The Rest of Our Lives by Benjamin Markovitz is available in print as an ebook and audio commercially. It's also available in audio and braille from RNIB. And Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll have more from Ben in Books of Your Life.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor, and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk. Now let's head back to the RNIB Library to find a couple of very different biographies narrated by their authors.
Young Once, A Life Less Heavy by Nigel Planer was given to us by John Murray from the Hachette Group.
I open the door to a man who's come to interview me and look through my archive boxes for an academic book he's writing about alternative comedy. He stands 6 foot tall and as thin as a piece of string. The perfect epitome of a 1980s alternative comedian. Except it's 2016. We all know what a 1980s alternative comedian looked like. A dark raglan coat to his knees, tight, tight trousers, large shoes, possibly Doc Martens, possibly brothel creepers, and a starved whippet of a face hanging underneath a flat pork pie hat. Except none of them, of us lot, did actually look or dress like that. Dr. Oliver Double does. Dr. Oliver Double is a scholar of comic and popular performance at the University of Kent, where there is a British stand-up archive that must be the largest store of source material on the subject in the country. Using online access, you can browse items such as the Tony Allen Collection, mostly audio of Tony circa 1979, the Arnold Brown Collection, posters, tickets, set lists, Josie Long's scrapbook for 1998, or, with an appointment and the right antique video player, you might be able to view an old VHS tape with a greasy peeling label which says Andy de la Tour and Rick Mayall live in Paignton, 21st of December, 1989.
Both a memoir and a love story, Young Ones follows his journey from bell ringer to gravedigger and all the other bizarre events that shape him until the day he meets Alexei Sale, Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson in a former strip club and the 1980s comedy revolution is born. It's lucky that he's always had a talent for seeing the funny side of things, whether it's dealing with a 20-foot eclair-related injury or being controlled into Band-Aid by Bob Geldof, gate-crashing a rave with Robin Williams or crashing into the set on Top of the Pops, becoming a grandfather at 29, or being rescued from disaster by musical theatre. Against a backdrop of squats, Glastonbury and roller discos, with a supporting cast that includes Lemmy, a stony-faced Robert De Niro, and French and Saunders, Young Ones is a wildly entertaining and gloriously sideways glimpse into a remarkable life and career. It's also an object lesson in why you should never give up looking for your happy ever after. It might well turn out to be right in front of you.
Dr. Oliver Double and I take a thermos into the gardens of the London Square where I live. It's early June 2016, and Britain has not yet voted by its whacking great landslide of under 3% to leave the EU. We're months away from the concept of Trump. It's a bright day, and we sit on the bench under a cherry tree. Dr. Double starts with the basic questions, the ones I've been asked many times before, the same ones that have been asked since about 1985. I feel a bit like Tina Turner. Not in the sense of being a powerful singing life force, of course, but more in the sense of repeating the same origin story again and again. Though the alternative comedian's origin story is a lot less dramatic and considerably less poignant. I feel we were merely passing on the baton. Itmar, the crazy gang, the goons, Python, grown-ups being silly.
Young Ones, A Life Less Heavy. Written and read by Nigel Planer. Runs for 9 hours and 59 minutes.
Book of Lives, a memoir of sorts, by Margaret Atwood, was donated by Penguin Random House.
Some years ago, I was asked to make a stunt appearance on a comedy show. The host, Rick Mercer, was doing a series in which people well known for one kind of accomplishment, such as writing, astonished viewers by doing something different and entirely unrelated, such as rolling a joint. "I want you to be a hockey goalie," Rick said. "Oh, I don't think so," I said. "Couldn't I just maybe bake a pie or something?" "Nope, you gotta be a goalie." "Why?" "Because it'll be funny, trust me." So I was a goalie in a full set of pads with gloves and a stick. There I am on YouTube, still goalie-ing it up. And yes, it is kind of funny. I wore my own little white figure skates with black socks over them to make them look like hockey skates. But you can't slide and stack the pads in figure skates, so those feats were performed by a body double, an accomplished women's hockey player. With her face mask on, you can't tell that it isn't me. It's the job of the body double to take the risks you yourself are too sedate or chicken or unaccomplished to take. I wish I could have a body double in my real life, I thought.
Immerse yourself in the creative universe of Margaret Atwood for a ride of life, art, and everything in between. Raised by scientifically minded parents, Atwood spent most of each year in the wild forest of northern Quebec, a vast playground for her etymologist's father, an independent, resourceful mother. It was an unfettered and nomadic childhood, sometimes isolated, but also thrilling and beautiful. From this unconventional start, Atwood unfolds the story of her life, linking key moments to the books that have shaped our literary landscape, from the cruel school year that would become Cat's Eye, to the unease of 1980s Berlin, where she began The Handmaid's Tale. In pages alive with the natural world, reading and books, major political turning points, and her lifelong love for the charismatic writer Graham Gibson, we meet poets, bears, Hollywood stars, and larger-than-life characters straight from the pages of an Atwood novel. As she explores her past, Atwood reveals more and more about her writing, the connections between real life and art, and the workings of one of her boldest imaginations.
Some months after my sixth novel, The Handmaid's Tale, had been published, I was doing a book event to promote it. During audience question time, with open mics which many folks present used to deliver sermons, a man gave his opinion. "So, The Handmaid's Tale is autobiography," he said. It wasn't a question. "No, it's not," I said. "Yes, it is." "No, it's not. It's set in the future," I said. "That's no excuse," he said. He was wrong, needless to say. Within my own lived experience, I had not donned a red outfit and a white bonnet and been coerced into procreating for the top brass of a theological hierarchy. But in a very broad sense, he was right. Everything that gets into your writing has gone through your mind in some form. You may mix and match and create new chimeras, but the primary materials have to have traveled through your head. Is autobiography only a series of events that have happened to you in the physical world, or is it also a record of an inner journey? Is it like Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, Here's How I Made My Hut, or is it more like Newman's Apologia Pro Vita Sua, Here's Why I Changed My Faith?
Book of Lives, a memoir of sorts, written and read by Margaret Atwood, runs for 25 hours and 36 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Ben Markowitz for the books of his life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I was thinking about that. Yeah, so, I mean, I could pick a lot of different books, but the one I've chosen is the Encyclopedia Brown stories. So they're written by Donald Sobel, I think, in the 1960s. They're kind of a small-town American kid version of the Sherlock Holmes stories. He's a kid detective. His father is the police chief. Each of the stories is about 10, 12 pages long. His sidekick is Sally Kimball, the coolest girl in his primary school. And together, they tackle the unsolved crimes of their more or less peaceful neighborhood in which they grow up. And at the end of every story, Encyclopedia reveals that he's figured out who the culprit was, and you have to see if you can figure it out yourself from the clues that the story has dropped. And then the answers are at the back of the book. And I used to read these stories with my mother in the evening over hot chocolates, and I got huge pleasure from them, and my kids have gotten huge pleasure from them as well.
For the last 2 years, the beach running along the seaside town of Idaville had been voted America's most beautiful beach. The white sand was so bright, you needed sunglasses to keep your eyeballs from getting sunburned. Like many small towns, Idaville had its share of banks, movie theaters, and car washes. There was a town square with a flagpole in the center. Surrounding the square were stores and a popular cafe. A classic car show was held each year to celebrate the 4th of July, followed by a fireworks display at the town's only pier. What made Idaville unique, however, was that for over a year, no criminal had escaped arrest and no boy or girl had gotten away with breaking a single law. Everyone in the state believed Idaville had the finest police force and the smartest chief of police. But Chief Brown and his wife knew the real reason. Idaville's best detective was their only child, a 10-year-old boy in sneakers. They called him Leroy, and so did his teachers. The rest of Idaville called him Encyclopedia. That's because his head was filled with more facts than a set of books called an encyclopedia. He could recall any of those facts in an instant. Every evening after work, Chief Brown would pull into the driveway of his red brick home at 13 Rover Avenue. If there was a case that needed solving, he knew the solution would be found during dinner. At dinner, Encyclopedia would listen to the case that baffled his father. Encyclopedia would close his eyes, as he always did when it was time to concentrate. Many claimed they could hear the sound of a tornado as the facts swirled in his head. But before the meal ended, Encyclopedia would have cracked the case. Encyclopedia solved the crimes, but his dad got all the credit. Chief Brown couldn't let anyone know that Idaville's top detective was his 10-year-old son. Who would believe him? But it didn't bother Encyclopedia one bit. He didn't want any extra attention or a reason to be treated differently than the other fifth graders.
Jason Harris reading from Encyclopedia Brown and the Case of the Marshmallow Tower. A new Encyclopedia Brown book by Donald Sobel's son, Eric Sobel, It's available commercially.
Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yeah, so the book I picked for that category is Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome. And in fact, during the pandemic, I don't know how old he was then. He was probably 11 or 12 years old. My son used to listen to the audio version of this wonderful book day after day after day. It's just a beautiful and extremely funny book that captures the funniness of friendship, the way that people who like each other make each other laugh as they go on a boat journey along the Thames.
Then we discussed the food question. George said, "Begin with breakfast." George is so practical. "Now, for breakfast, we shall want a frying pan." Harris said it was indigestible, but we merely urged him not to be an ass, and George went on. "A teapot and a kettle and a methylated spirit stove." "No oil," said George, with a significant look, and Harris and I agreed. We'd taken up an oil stove once, but never again. It had been like living in an oil shop that week. It oozed. I never saw such a thing as paraffin oil is to ooze. We kept it in the nose of the boat, and from there it oozed down to the rudder, impregnating the whole boat and everything in its way. And it oozed over the river and saturated the scenery and spoiled the atmosphere. Sometimes a westerly, oily wind blew, and at other times an easterly, oily wind. And sometimes it blew a northerly, oily wind, and maybe a southerly, oily wind. But whether it came from the Arctic snows or was raised in the waste of the desert sands, it came alike to us laden with the fragrance of paraffin oil. And that oil oozed up and ruined the sunset. And as for the moonbeams, they positively reeked of paraffin. We tried to get away from it at Marlow. We left the boat by the bridge and took a walk through the town to escape it. But it followed us. The whole town was full of oil. We passed through the churchyard, and it seemed as if the people had been buried in oil. The high street stunk of oil. We wondered how people could live in it. And we walked miles upon miles out Birmingham way. But it was no use. The country was steeped in oil. At the end of that trip, we met together at midnight in a lonely field under a blasted oak and took an awful oath. We'd been swearing for a whole week about the thing in an ordinary middle-class way, but this was a swell affair. An awful oath never to take paraffin oil with us in a boat again, except, of course, in case of sickness. Therefore, in the present instance, we confined ourselves to methylated spirit. Even that is bad enough. You get methylated pie and methylated cake. But methylated spirit is more wholesome when taken into the system in large quantities than paraffin oil.
That's Michael Aspel reading from Three Men in a Boat, To Say Nothing of the Dog, by Jerome K. Jerome, which is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by both Michael Aspel or Martin Jarvis.
Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, Helm by Sarah Hall. It just came out. It's a novel about a wind. And there are a lot of great books that open up a human view of the world that you'd never thought of before. But there are also some novels that open up a more alien perspective on our lives. I'm thinking of a few classic examples. Moby Dick is one. There was a great book called The Overstory by Richard Powers, which looks at the world through the trees that are in it. And Helm does the same thing for the only named wind in Britain. It takes us through the ages and the different people who have attempted at various points to measure it or control it. It's really an amazing, amazing book.
Helm doesn't know when Helm was born, or brewed, conjured or conceived, first formed above the highest mountain, first blown into the valley, long before humankind, that brief, busy interlude. Time happens all at once for Helm, more or less, relative to longevity. A blink of the eye, universally. Warning, Helm loves clichés, typical for English weather. Something of a disorder, some would say. Of what fantastical, phenomenal, and calculable things Helm is made. Maleficence and data and law. Atmospheric principles and folk tales, spirit and substance, opposites and inversions. So many identities and personalities, it makes Helm's head spin. In the beginning, there was no Helm. Boring for the world, obviously. There were eons before Helm arrived. The necessary arrangements had to be made on the planet and in the sky. It would take ages for Helm to be recognised, let alone named. During which, Helm suffered loneliness, inconsequence and ignorance, an original and terrible fugue state. Or, Helm didn't care. Helm was just on standby. But in the beginning, nothing else had a name either, or a pronoun, or a preference. There was no godly language. There was no creative designer or clerical administrator. No titler of the things. It was all serious planetary business. A tremendous collision making Earth and its moon. Sun shrinking and getting hotter. Everything bilious, oxygenless. Not great for living. Earth was hot and cold, etc. for millennia. Fevers and chills, blah, blah.
That's Louise Breeley reading from Helm by Sarah Hall, available both commercially and from RNIB. And once again, Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.